Welcome back to another episode of the End of Time podcast. My next guest is Professor Ram Mason from the University of East Anglia's School of Politics, Philosophy, Language and Communication Studies. Professor Ram Mason is an international relations specialist with an emphasis on Japan and has co-authored numerous books, including Japan's Relations with North Korea and the Recalibration of Risk. Professor Mason, thank you for joining me on the podcast.
Lovely to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so I hear that you're in Okinawa right now.
I am in Okinawa right now, yes.
So, I mean, it's perfect because this whole kind of episode I wanted to touch on is about Japan, it's about the rise of China and the Indo-Pacific as a whole. So as an expert on Japan, post-World War II with the destruction of Japan, Japan has turned into the US's most trusted ally in Asia. And having the US ruled the country right up until, in some capacity, up into the 1970s, how is the current US-Japan relationship influenced by this?
Yeah, it's influenced a lot. So, I mean, I would maybe just
point
out two points of contention as far as that goes, which is that to say that I agree, I think that Japan is the United States' most trusted ally in Asia, but I think the South Koreans might have something to say about that. They also have a very close alliance. And in terms of being ruled until the 1970s, well, Okinawa specifically. So Japan technically was, you know, given back its sovereignty in 1953, but Okinawa remained separate from the rest of the body of Japan and, as you point out, wasn't actually returned to Japanese control or reverted to Japanese control until 1972. So it has a very special status, and Okinawa, now that the United States is in such a rivalry with China, is particularly important because it sits right in the middle of what they call the first island chain, which runs down towards China and is the so-called keystone of the Pacific. So it's pivotal to that alliance.
Why do you think that Okinawa was held on by the US up until the early 1970s? Was it because they anticipated that Okinawa's presence within the first island chain was going to be of some significance in the future with the rise of China?
That was part of it, definitely. There were also financial incentives and there were some historical reasons. I mean, you have to remember that in 1945, Okinawa was absolutely devastated. It had just experienced the only main Japanese land battle, that's the Battle of Okinawa, which was bloodier, believe it or not, the actual battle than the combination of Hiroshima and Nagasaki combined. It was also the scene of some horrific wartime atrocities committed by both the invading Americans or allies and by the Japanese Imperial Army towards the Okinawan people. And around a third of the Okinawan population were killed in that battle. So at the end of that very bloody battle, the Americans decided they would hold on to Okinawa, obviously as the victorious side, and build bases and installations that would initially were going to be used to launch a major offensive onto the mainland of Japan, but in the end became used as a bastion against the evolving Cold War. So in other words, a bastion against the Soviet Union and beyond that against communist China.
Is there a sense from local I mean, you can only speak from your experience and your expertise, but is there a sort of resistance from the local Okinawan population regarding the US's long-standing historical influence and the influence and with military bases up until today?
Yeah, absolutely. Because you also have to bear in mind that Okinawa was originally not part of the United States or Japan. It was its own kingdom, the Ryukyu Kingdom. And so there is this historical authenticity that Okinawa has the right to independence or certainly to self-determination. And there is a great deal of resentment towards both mainland Japan and particularly to the United States now because of the fact that the burden of these bases that are still there as a legacy of the Cold War is massively disproportionate vis-a-vis the population and the size of the islands. So you have 70% roughly of all US bases in Japan stationed on this tiny island in Okinawa, and the island, the main island, and the other off islands make up around only 0.6% of Japan's total land mass. So you can see the massive disproportionality there. And, you know, bases bring crime, they bring noise, they bring pollution, they create a target for any potential adversary. So all of these things are very much resented on Okinawa, yes.
Has there been an attempt by local Okinawans to try and push out the US influence and these military bases, as well as in the mainland Japan?
Well, there are certainly protest movements, and there are regular protests as well, particularly when, you know, egregious crimes occur. So probably the most famous example was the 1995 rape case where three US Marines raped a 12-year-old girl. There was also several incidents where helicopters have crashed into, for example, an international university, or parts of helicopters or other military vehicles have caused damage, releases of serious pollutants into the atmosphere and into the rivers and so on. All of these bring particular points of protest. But the problem is, I would say, threefold, or at least twofold. The first part of that is that although the Okinawans, by a large majority, would like to see the number of bases reduced, and to a smaller majority would like to see the bases removed completely, there is the issue that the bases, although they bring all of these problems, do also bring a degree of employment, and also they bring a degree of security. So there is a kind of contradiction on Okinawa whereby the majority of the population, something like 70%, would like to see the majority of bases, US bases, either removed or scaled back or relocated somewhere outside of Okinawa Prefecture. But at the same time, 80% of Okinawans would like to see the continuation of a strong US-Japan alliance. So you see there's kind of a contradiction in the sense that US-Japan alliance implies the maintenance or the sustenance of those bases. Now, of course, you could say, well, that's not the case. You know, US-Japan alliance can still be strong and not be stationed on Okinawa. But it's obvious that if there were an immediate contingency in the region, for example, with China, less likely with North Korea, but these are the contingencies that the Japanese government holds up and also the US State Department. In those cases, Okinawa would need some kind of credible defense, and that would involve the US military. So that's a big contradiction.
We talk about the Japanese self-defense forces and agree that Okinawans feel the need for security within a quite dangerous Indo-Pacific at the moment. So the fact that the Japanese self-defense forces are considering, I mean, the government is considering revoking Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution, at least talking about it. And that, for anybody who doesn't know what Article 9 is, it essentially prevents their armed forces being able to develop for capacity for war, I think. So I think there are two questions I get from this. Is the talk of revoking this Article 9 of the Constitution a mechanism for peace? And how has this potentially impacted the politics and security of the Indo-Pacific?
Yeah, very, very good question and very big question.
Yes.
One that probably I won't be able to answer in entirety on this podcast. But I'll offer you some thoughts in response to that. Is the reversion of Article 9 a move for peace? Well, that depends on where you stand and whose perspective you're talking from. But from the perspective of Okinawa, in one sense, it would at least enable the further deployment and a more credible defense for, or by, I should say, the Japan Self-Defense Force, the JSDF, vis-a-vis the current stationing of massive amounts of American military personnel. So in other words, that contradiction that we were just talking about would be partly alleviated, and is being partly alleviated, by the further deployment of JSDF forces in place of the US military. And obviously, if Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution were amended, or revised, as they like to say, it would allow the JSDF to have a, you know, forward power projection capability, or potentially something along those lines, that would mean that it wouldn't have to be relying on US support in order to enter into kind of battleground or warfighting operations. That said, you know, as those two terms that I just mentioned kind of allude to, right, you know, we're talking about warfighting here. So this is not really a move for peace. You know, the Japanese establishment, particularly the ruling LDP, have talked a lot in recent years, really since former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, of proactive pacifism, which is a little bit of an oxymoron in a lot of people's minds. And these are all things that go hand in hand with the idea of revising the constitution. But what stops Japan as much as anything from actually realizing that is the fact that the surrounding powers, particularly China, but other mainland Asian states, would react extremely badly to the idea of Japan officially revising its constitution. In reality, it has hollowed out that constitution to the point of almost non-recognition. I mean, Japan does deploy troops all over the world. It has an overseas base in Djibouti. It, you know, engages in peacekeeping operations that involve live fire, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, the actual words of those constitution, which have remained unchanged since 1946, are no longer really recognizable de facto. But de jure, as they say, you know, in the eyes of the law, they remain unchanged, partly as a way to placate what would be a very negative reaction on mainland Asia.
I see. So with that, what role do you think Japan has in countering China's continued kind of sovereignty claim in the South China Sea and countering overall Chinese expansionism in the Indo-Pacific?
Yeah, also very, very important questions, and ones that I can almost literally see kind of taking place or taking shape outside of my window here, you know, as I watch military aircraft fly back and forth. From the perspective of Okinawa, you know, it's really more important that the East China Sea is dealt with. And I think this is something which often goes under the radar. The South China Sea is where, you know, as you rightly point out, where China is expanding most rapidly. It's already built 7 concrete installations, which we know can be at the, you know, the flip of a switch or the raise of a hand transformed into military bases. It's, you know, patrolling and blocking lines of navigation through the Malacca Straits and in and around those areas of the Spratly Islands and the Paracel Islands in the South China Sea. But really all Japan can do in response to that is what it is doing, which is to mobilize its Coast Guard, which sits outside of the military budget, outside of the military restrictions, because it's officially part of the Japanese police. So it uses its Coast Guard to both train other coast guards in the region, so Indonesia, for example, Philippines, and so on, and also to provide support patrols with the United States. So the Coast Guard has been kind of boosted to the point of, again, almost, you know, a fourth arm of the Japanese de facto military, and it's a Coast Guard that would, you know, probably take on our Navy. I think it's become quite spectacular in terms of the equipment it has. It's not, you know, throwing out rubber rings and saving people that are drowning. But at the same time, the Coast Guard has to deal with the East China Sea, which is much more immediate if you're here on the Japanese, you know, inhabited territories, which, of course, Okinawa is the last point of. And specifically, there is the disputed islands of Senkaku Diaoyu, which are administered from Ishigaki Island in Okinawa. And so we actually have a situation out there in the East China Sea right now where Chinese Coast Guards and Japanese Coast Guards are patrolling and they're blasting these announcements at each other, off boats, at fishing vessels and other non-military vessels that enter the area, telling each other and each other's fishing vessels to get out of the area because they are invading sovereign space. Now, de facto, Japan still controls that, and you have the maritime JSDF, that's effectively the Japanese Navy, and you also have the American 7th Fleet sat just off the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands, ready to enter into any contingency where China were to actually land on them. But whilst China is only operating in the maritime space, that's to say only at sea, the Japanese and Americans are very keen to avoid escalation. And so that's a developing situation, and it's one that as China grows in strength, it is increasingly unilaterally altering the status quo out there in and around the Senkaku Diaoyu Island. So I think in some ways we should have our eyes as much on the East China Sea as the South China Sea.
From an international law perspective, what is going on with those islands? Does Japan have legal sovereignty, or is it similar to the Taiwan situation where it's kind of up in the air? Everybody knows that it's its own sovereign country. At the same time, it's legally not.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting comparison. I would actually say that it's fundamentally different to the Taiwan situation in that the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands, so these were islands which they were used as a navigational aid going back as far as Ming China. So this is really the roots of both Chinese and actually Taiwanese claims to the islands. The Chinese call them Tiaoyutai. But those claims are very tenuous and were only kind of exerted with any force when oil was discovered in and around the islands in the 1960s, whereas the Japanese claims to the islands date back to the Japanese victory in the First Sino-Japanese War and the Meiji Restoration and the Meiji, the Treaty of Shimonoseki and the legalized formal annexation or incorporation of those islands into Japanese sovereign territory. They were then obviously lost to the Americans or the Allies when World War II was lost, but they were given what's called residual sovereignty to Japan. So that's to say that when Okinawa was returned to Japanese rule, that the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands were also returned as Japanese sovereign territory at that point in 1972. So legally speaking, there is really very little room for dispute under international law that these are Japanese sovereign territory. However, as we know, China does not, adhere to international law and particularly doesn't adhere to international arbitration over territorial claims. So China is increasingly and vociferously pushing forward its claims over Senkaku Diaoyu Island, and it's backing it up increasingly with this very physical Coast Guard presence. And to give you one quick example of how that's actually altering out there, the Chinese have adapted or kind of converted some of their former Navy vessels into Coast Guard ships. So simply put, they've written Coast Guard on the side of a Navy ship, right? The Japanese have not responded in kind. They've invested. They've invested in drones. They've invested in other kinds of Coast Guard equipment and have one of the most effective and advanced Coast Guards in the world. But it's not going to match actual military hardware that China is beginning to put out there. So we're seeing physically the balance of power shift in and around the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands. And the big question is going to be, what, if anything, do the American and Japanese state authorities and beyond that, the US Navy and or the Maritime Self-Defense Force do about this in the mid to long term? At the moment, it suits both sides to maintain their own claims and to avoid actual escalation. But there comes a point where China's tilting of the balance of power will become so lopsided that it will be very difficult for Japan to maintain that de facto sovereignty.
That's a very, very interesting point. And you bring up that China is continuously, and it's acting within that balance of power to try and exert its claims. So what is China's goal in the long term? Is it a fundamental reshaping of the international system? Because yes, we all acknowledge that China's rejected a lot of international arbitration when it comes to the South China Sea. But at the same time, it's used the American-led international system for its own benefit in terms of its economy. So what is China's goal? Is it to fundamentally reshape the international system for its own interests? Or what is another alternative motive?
Well, I think there is a sense in which we tend to frame the China issue or the rise of China in very Western-centric terms. So we see, for example, the international system as fixed and material and something that can either perhaps be dominated by the United States or by China, or perhaps by a combination of China and Russia or the extended BRICS or whatever else. And there's no doubt that China is increasing its influence and seeking to further increase its influence. But if you read leading scholarship from China, which is closely affiliated to Chinese state authorities, and you can do this in translated text or obviously in the original text, but it suggests, or at least for a large part, that the Chinese mindset is one of developing a new kind of thinking about the international system. So, for example, there's authors like Yan Xichuang, who has authored what's called Yan's moral realism, these kinds of things. They have this almost Confucian-esque underlying morality or underlying ethos or conceptualization of the world, which is fundamentally different to this Westphalian idea that we have, right? This idea that's often put forward in the West. When I talk about we, I'm really talking about the Western states as we've defined them under Westphalian system. So very state-centric, very much about material power, very much about how that is then funneled through institutions, and those institutions allow a certain kind of governance and a certain amount of control over a large area. Now, you may be cynical and realist about this and say, well, yeah, at the end, it doesn't really matter what's underlying this as a concept, because in the end, it comes down to the ability to wield and project power. But I think it is important because it affects the individual decisions that China makes in terms of how and where it intervenes in different points of pressure or different flashpoints. And so, the case of the East China Sea or the South China Sea may well develop into one of those areas where we get, and maybe even Taiwan as well, where we see, results which are difficult to predict because China is not thinking out of the same kind of mindset that a US or NATO or, Western writ large think tank or policy group or whatever else would be thinking out of. And we also see this in Ukraine, right? And also in the Middle East, where China has extensive influence, but it has not been exercised in the way that we would either expect from European style colonialism or from American imperialism or Russian interventionism. So, I think we have to give some credence to the idea that China will develop its own worldview or develop through its own worldview in order to increase that power and influence.
Reminds me of a book I just finished. It's called was called Destined for War by Graham Allison, and he talks about this exact kind of concept. It's totally two different mindsets. With Confucius, China sees itself as the center of civilization and humanity.
Yeah, I think there's a tendency, it is a very interesting area. I think there's a tendency in Japan and the United States, for that matter, to kind of start the clock again at somewhere in the middle of August 1945, or perhaps in the Japanese case, sometime in 1953. And from a Chinese perspective, this is just insane, right? You've got a civilization which is thousands of years old, which is, from their perspective, looking at some upstart in the United States that has barely been a country for 200 years, and you're looking at some outlier in Japan, which has historically been isolationist for a long time, and prior to that, or at least immediately after that, particularly, quite aggressive and expansionist. So you can see where it's very straightforward from a Chinese perspective to look at these two, it's sort of somewhat rival and at times aggressive rival powers and see them as somehow fundamentally on a totally different footing from the authority that they can exert in terms of their middle kingdom and the ethos and the authority that is given or imbued to that through this massive historical legacy. However, I think, you know, on the other hand, Japan, don't forget, is the longest monarchy, or, you know, longest constitutional monarchy as it is now, but really, you know, the longest monarchy that goes back through time in terms of being hundreds of years old. It is one of the most ancient civilizations in Asia, despite the comparison to China. And it has a very distinct and specific worldview, which does supersede in the longer term the post-World War II era. But modern Japanese policymaking is very much invested in the Japanese miracle that took place through the guidance of the United States and partly in response to US foreign policy and US financial interests that drove those foreign policies after World War II. And so what I mean by that is that although Japan still has these roots in a very long-standing and deep tradition and an ancient culture, it has managed to kind of map those onto a complete redefining and reinventing of itself in the post-World War II era. And that reinventing included not just blindly following the United States and acting as a bulwark, which is what the United States wanted, and also acting as a market for the United States goods. It went way beyond those expectations and actually reinvented itself and recreated the kind of miracle innovation that we saw from Japan in the post-industrial revolution age. That's to say, Japan undertaking its industrial revolution in 40 or 50 years, where it took European states, you know, 150 years, and then almost doing the same thing in the post-World War II era, where it caught up with, exceeded and surpassed European states, and then actually challenged the United States to the point where it ran up a huge trade surplus against what had been, you know, the power that it was relying upon. So Japan has this confidence which comes in waves, and the big challenge for Japan now is to find a way to revitalize that once again, because we've got stagnation here. We've got two or three decades where Japan's economy hardly grows. We have a situation where Japan is rapidly aging, it's short of workers, it's resistant and somewhat kind of immobile in terms of, for example, innovating through immigration and those kinds of things, and opening up its market further. So all of these things present a big, big challenge for Japan vis-a-vis China, because China has done a great job of that in the last 20 years, right? It has managed to expand very, very rapidly economically, and that's led to the ability for China, for example, to actually surpass Japan and become the world's second largest economy. So Japan grapples around for a new identity that can actually match and beat China, and I think so far it hasn't come up with the answers.
You talk about the revitalization of Japanese identity and a collective identity. I think that's what China's done so well, that they've managed to mobilize the entire population under this guise of China is gonna, we're gonna get back to number one. We're gonna be here for as long as time is begun. So is Japan also experiencing something that is happening in the West in terms of a lack of collective identity and individualism taking the forefront of all, like, that kind of society and culture?
I think it's less a case of individualism as a case of some very fundamental structural issues that Japan is not able at the moment to effectively deal with. I mean, one of them is simply conservatism. That's to say, Japan is a very conservative country. Its ruling party, the LDP, the Liberal Democratic Party, is not liberal, not very democratic, and barely even a party. And in that sense, it's basically a conservative party, and it's almost a one-party state in the terms of how long it's ruled. So these things create these long-standing relationships between, for example, business and politics and bureaucracy, Japan's so-called Iron Triangle. And it means that there is really a lack of flexibility and innovation that is going to provide the kinds of certainly technological advances, but also social transformation that would really be required to give Japan that new identity. And I think what tends to happen, as we've seen with recent prime ministers, is they package old wine in a new bottle, and they really fall back on quite nationalist ideals for Japan. You know, the sort of traditionalist idea evoking, you know, great eras gone by, evoking a sense of pride in things that are very Japanese, because Japan has a lot of unique, you know, elements, whether that be the autumn leaves, you know, or the cherry blossom, or a particular kind of food, or all of these things become kind of national tropes, or even Japanese rice, for example, you know, all of these things that they kind of evoke a sense of national pride within the Japanese population, but they're not things which have this bright, innovative future. They're things which rely on some past romanticism about what Japan was. And because Japan is such an aging society, until Japan fundamentally alters its immigration policies, it's not going to see a level of productivity and revamping of the economy that is really needed. I mean, it is a leading, I should just quickly caveat that by saying, it is a leading innovator in certain key technological sectors, robotics, for example. But even in there, things like AI and robotics, areas where Japan is strong, it looks unlikely that they're going to be sufficient to make up that shortfall that's actually needed from human capital.
It's an interesting kind of development, and something I was not previously aware of. I can't lie. Well, we all hear about the aging population situation, and that's not just affecting Japan, it's affecting Korea as well. And recently, China as well is suffering from a very, very big population kind of crisis at the moment. So, but is there a sense of hope that, because you do talk about how it's a one-party state, it's hardly democratic, it's a conservative kind of mindset. Is there a bit of hope that the system itself can be fundamentally changed? And are there any clear and obvious kind of ways forward?
I think the answer to the last question is a definite no. There are not clear and straightforward ways forward. I should say that a lot of both scholars in Japan and outside of Japan, commenting on Japan, would take issue with my idea of describing it somewhat provocatively as a one-party state. I mean, Japan is a functioning constitutional democracy in the sense that it has, you know, a bimacarial system, you know, two proper houses, an upper house, a lower house, proper elections, relatively transparent elections. All of these things provide the appearance of a functioning democracy. But nevertheless, the reality is that it has been ruled for all but a handful of years since 1955 by the same conservative party with the same basic vested interests that support the same kinds of leading companies and the same kinds of policies, including on things like immigration. So that's the sense in which it's a one-party state, or at least a one-party establishment. And there's been really nobody to come along and challenge that from outside of that party system. You know, there has been a very brief period, a couple of years between 2009 to 2012, and before that in the mid-90s, where formally at least an opposition party took power. But even in those cases, in the latter case, you know, the members that took power were, in many respects, spin-offs of, you know, former members of the current ruling party. So there really is a problem with a functioning change in administration that would bring in a whole set of very different or innovative policies. I mean, there's hope in lots of other areas of Japanese society, and certainly in kinds of tech and technological companies. There are innovations taking place, but they're still operating within an environment which is relatively immobile. And so that really constrains or limits what Japan can do, particularly when it's trying to compete against the likes of China, of South Korea, of Taiwan. And so I think, you know, we would need, there are one or two figures that are almost like waves in the distance who are younger, more kind of open-minded, perhaps more open to a flexible immigration policy, or at least to further deregulating or restructuring parts of the Japanese economy. People like Koizumi Jr. And others who maybe could come in at some point in the mid to longer term future and transform the Japanese political system. But there's a huge amount of inertia, and that makes it very, very challenging.
I think that's...
There is a bit of hope then. From what I gather, there is hope, and there is room, there's some tiny bit of wiggle room. But I think that's a very, very interesting discussion, and I'm very, very glad that you took the time to come onto the podcast, because clearly I'm very under, I don't know enough about Japan and the whole kind of political environment on there. But I want to ask one final question, I ask this to all my guests, and is how would you like to be remembered? It's a big question, and God forbid anything were to happen, but how would you like to be remembered in the grand scheme of things?
Well, thank you very much for asking the question. I think, if anything, as somebody that observes and works on Japan and international relations, I would like to be remembered as somebody that has in some way contributed to spotlighting the issues that Okinawa faces. And I think, you know, it's a pity that Okinawa is known mostly, certainly, you know, in the UK, it's known mostly for probably Kill Bill and maybe Karate Kid for people that are a little bit older. And really, it should be known as an incredible and unique island that, you know, should be and is, in many respects, the Hawaii of Japan. and it should be peaceful and prosperous. And, you know, I would love to be somebody that's remembered as contributing to that peace and prosperity on Okinawa.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for your time. And I fundamentally really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Nick. I appreciate it.